This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate liability and constitutional law bring us our lead story today. Where does consumer privacy end and patriotism begin? In a courtroom, for all we know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday. Today is usually the last day of February. It's the 28th, but not this year. Good to have you with us. President Bush had a couple of things he wanted to talk about during his press conference today. More money to fight AIDS, how he's not all that interested in another economic stimulus package, and mostly why he wants Congress to pass his warrantless wiretapping program.
You cannot expect phone companies to participate if they feel like they're going to be sued. I mean, these people are responsible for shareholders. They're private companies.
Congress and the White House have been going back and forth over this topic for more than a year now. An extension of what's called the Protect America Act expired almost 2 weeks ago. The administration wants retroactive immunity for telecommunications companies that have handed over customer calling records since September the 11th. Some Democrats in the House don't. The president's message today was pretty simple. He promised them it'd be okay.
The government said to those who have alleged to have helped us that it is in our national interest and it's legal.
The companies thought they were on solid ground when they acted. They just never thought that the word of the executive branch wouldn't be good enough. And so that's going to be an important precedent if it does get litigated.
Phil Weiser is a professor of law and telecommunications at the University of Colorado. We called him because, well, nobody here is a lawyer. He reminded us that while many phone companies did give the government what it wanted, one of them, Quest, didn't.
Because Quest did not provide that information, that underscores the other companies who did provide the information were making an affirmative choice. And going forward, the attitudes of these companies may well be more concerned about their customers' privacy interests and less accommodating to the government's requests.
Moving on now to other companies and their customers' interests. Sears reported a 48% drop in quarterly profits today. Yes, a faltering economy had probably something to do with that, but Sears has been falling behind its competitors for years. Now there's speculation the 121-year-old retailer's very survival is on the line. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
There was a time when the Sears name alone might have been insulation against these tough times. No longer, says Joel Naroff, chief economist of Commerce Bank.
A lot of consumers, especially the younger consumers, are looking for the newest things. They're not married necessarily to an individual brand name. So maintaining brand loyalty, especially for an older brand, becomes extremely difficult under these circumstances.
Hedge fund manager Edward Lampert took control of the Sears and Kmart chains 3 years ago. Same-store sales at both chains have declined every quarter since then. Retail consultant Howard Davidowitz says the country's sixth-largest retail company is losing out to more efficient, better-stocked, less expensive competitors.
Like a Target, like a Walmart, like a Penny's, the consumers are voting with their feet.
Last month, Sears Holdings announced another corporate reorganization. Board Chairman Lampert ousted the CEO and cut 200 jobs at headquarters. Several top executives then left the company, and the search for a new CEO continues. Davidowitz says the weak consumer economy couldn't come at a worse time for Sears.
That is just going to, of course, magnify Sears' problems. The worst is yet to come, and I think these negatives are going to accelerate as we go forward.
He says the company's real estate may soon become more valuable than its retail stores. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
You know how every now and then we bring you a completely obscure term from the world of high finance and try to explain it? We're not doing that anymore, at least not for a little while. We figure you've had about all you can take of structured investment vehicles and auction rate securities. Suffice it to say, the municipal bond market took another turn for the worse this week. The latest to blow up are things called variable rate demand notes. Look that one up for yourself if you really want to know, or drop us a line. We'll tell you. What it means in practice, though, is that cities and states are seeing their borrowing costs more than quadruple while revenues are going downhill. From New York, Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports now on the double whammy of the real estate crash and the credit crunch.
The gods seem to be conspiring against municipalities these days. A couple weeks ago, their borrowing costs soared when something called auction rate bonds fell apart. Now the same thing has happened with this other finance source.
Well, it's like the next shoe dropping. Who knows how many shoes we have out there to drop?
That's Cynthia Kroll. She's a regional economist at the Fisher Center at UC Berkeley. The city of Vallejo, California, may declare bankruptcy this evening. She says that could affect residents in a number of ways.
They'll close libraries. I think they're talking about rotating among fire stations so that they don't have to pay so much overtime. The city will have less in the way of public safety services as recreation services are often the first thing to go. Maintenance, and you drive around the Bay Area and you can just see that already has gone in a lot of communities.
Local governments across the country are expected to feel this downturn a lot more than the last one. That's because cities rely on property taxes as their main source of revenue. Robin Prunty is a senior director in the public finance department at Standard & Poor's.
We expect that local governments will face greater challenges this time around because of the real estate market being much weaker. When you look back at 2001 recession, real estate was really one of the big strengths in the economy.
Prunty doesn't expect many cities to go bankrupt.
I think it's important to keep in mind that governments generally plan for rainy days. They keep reserves.
Prunty says if this downturn lasts just a year or two, most cities should weather the crisis. There may be fewer clerks at City Hall or fewer swim classes at the recreation center. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Ben Bernanke spent another day on Capitol Hill today, said about what he said yesterday. Wall Street liked it a whole lot less, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Say what you will about bureaucrats, and people do say plenty. The truth is, we need them. They keep the government running until they leave. The chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission said today she is stepping down. Deborah Platt Majoris is going to leave next month to become the general counsel at Procter & Gamble. Her departure leaves just four commissioners at the Federal Trade Commission, but it is far from the only agency in town with a vacuum at the top. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
The six-member Federal Election Commission is now down to two, which means it can't do its job, which means John McCain doesn't know if he has to abide by federal spending limits in his campaign for the presidency. Former FEC Chairman Michael Toner left a year ago for a major law firm.
There's never a perfect time to go, but I felt like it was an appropriate time to go. But I have to say, I never foresaw what has unfolded over the last year or so with this total stalemate on Capitol Hill.
That stalemate has also left the nation's Mine Safety Commission pretty useless and the Consumer Product Safety Commission. That agency regulates more than 15,000 products to keep the public safe from injury or death. Sorry, America, you're on your own.
When there isn't a quorum on multi-member agencies, big decisions on important issues just simply can't get made.
That's government regulation expert Kerry Colonnese at the University of Pennsylvania. He says these agencies can still do their day-to-day work and make small decisions, and that this happens at the end of every presidency. But Paul Light, an expert on presidential appointments, sees something different this time.
George Bush is having the worst eighth year of any two-term presidency since we created the two-term limitation.
But, he says,
I don't think there are a lot of tears being shed in the administration right now.
He says it comes down to an anti-regulation president versus a pro-regulation Congress. President Bush has nominated replacements, but when faced with the choice of some of the president's nominees and nobody, one Democratic senator said she'll take nobody. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There was a lot of economy alongside national security at the president's press conference this morning. He took a question about the Democratic candidates and their positions on the North American Free Trade Agreement. He turned it into a call for Congress to pass a free trade deal with Colombia. Out in Ohio, though, it's all NAFTA all the time this week. Primary day is next Tuesday. John McCain and Mike Huckabee will be on the Republican ballot, but it is the Democrats who are getting most of the press. Both campaigns have been sending out mailers to voters trying to claim their candidate is the one who's been opposed to the trade agreement the longest. From WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito reports.
Attend rallies in Ohio these days, and you'll hear a common theme.
Let's get real about the future of trade in this country. Let's get real about NAFTA. It simply isn't working for all Americans.
If you're ready for change, we can go ahead and say to the companies, we're taking away your tax breaks. If you ship jobs overseas, we're going to give those tax breaks to companies that invest right here in Youngstown and right here in Ohio.
Barack Obama says more than 50,000 jobs have been lost to NAFTA. Nationally, he says over 1 million jobs have been lost. Overall, though, the United States Trade Representative says the United States gained 25 million jobs since NAFTA went into effect in 1994. Still, in Ohio, manufacturing has taken a huge hit. So, as you can imagine, NAFTA and free trade agreements in general aren't very popular among union card-carrying Democrats. Paul Beck is a political scientist at Ohio State.
That particular group, and it's a very large group, is one that both candidates are courting very assiduously. And one understands why, because they could be the pivotal group within the Ohio electorate.
So the anti-NAFTA rhetoric is heating up. It's even more pointed because Clinton's husband, Bill, helped push NAFTA through in 1993. The Obama campaign recently sent out a mailer claiming Hillary Clinton once supported NAFTA. It's a claim the Clinton campaign rejects, but worker Eugene Jordan is paying close attention. His union, Service Employees International, has endorsed Obama.
It was her husband, Bill, that put that trade in place. So I can't see where she's going to change nothing at right now. You know, I mean, same old politics.
Retired steel worker Heather Boley was laid off from Timken, a maker of machine bearings, not long after NAFTA took effect in 1994. She says she's heard politicians make promises before.
They say a lot of things to get elected, and then when, you know, I was a Bush supporter, and he didn't turn out to do a lot of what he said either. You know, it's a very hard decision.
The Obama and Clinton proposals on trade aren't all that different, says Case Western Reserve economist Sue Helper. Both candidates would let people sue if a company didn't live up to labor and anti-pollution laws in other countries.
If we can change the trade agreement so that it's less attractive to compete on the basis of low wages and sweatshops and poor environmental conditions, that benefits both workers here in the U.S. and it also benefits the workers in other countries.
But workers like Matt Hewlett think that's not realistic. The 29-year-old's last day of work at the Hoover plant in North Canton was last Friday. Last year, a Hong Kong-based company bought Hoover, Now it's closed the 100-year-old plant and moved jobs to Texas and Mexico. Hewlett thinks politicians could have thought of solutions much earlier.
There's a lot they can do about it, but I think they already dug a hole deep enough that we can't even get out of it.
Hewlett doesn't believe politicians will change trade agreements that help companies compete globally, even at the expense of American jobs.
This country is still great. I mean, I wouldn't want to be born anywhere else, but the point is, it's like I look around and it's just like, don't tell me what I want to hear. Show me. Straight up just tell me, you know, it's going to be hard at first, but if everybody just helps and pulls together, we can do it.
He says he hasn't made up his mind who to vote for yet. He says he's so disgusted he might not vote for anybody this time. He's got better things to do, like find a new job. In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Marketplace.
How you feel about NAFTA probably depends a lot on how you feel about this question. Is free trade the reason the U.S. is losing blue-collar jobs? Or could there be some other things like technology or the efficiencies of innovation that are responsible? Whichever it is, people who've lost their jobs, at least in part because of trade deals, can get some government help. Commentator and economist Glenn Hubbard says Congress ought to just let that program die.
The Congress is considering a reauthorization and expansion of trade adjustment assistance, a program to help workers who can show that they lost their jobs because of international trade. Sounds good, right? Last year, the U.S. economy created about 30 million jobs while eliminating 28 million for a net gain of about 2 million jobs. But few serious commentators would point to trade as a primary engine of this job creation and destruction, really a byproduct of our dynamic and competitive economy. Economists are more likely to finger technology than trade in explaining job shifts. For example, going forward, job losses due to offshoring are likely to add less than 5% to normal weekly job turnover. President Reagan pointed this out about trade adjustment assistance. He said, "We wind up paying greater benefits to those who lose their jobs because of foreign competition than we do to their friends and neighbors who are hard off due to domestic competition. Anyone must agree that this is unfair." And while Congress is keen to talk about trade adjustment assistance, it doesn't seem so keen on trade. Increasing traditional unemployment benefits won't relieve the need to retrain for new occupations. There is a better way forward. We should make funds available to workers whose job loss is likely to be long-lasting for whatever reason. Placed in a personal reemployment account, such funds could be used for individualized training and income support. Letting individuals keep the balance if they find a new job quickly gives a reemployment bonus. We should also pursue tax reforms that would give all workers access to affordable health insurance that's portable. And of course, we should redouble our efforts to ensure that all workers have the education and skills to compete in a global economy. All in all, a better trade.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to run the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. Where are you on free trade? Tell us, and tell us what you think we ought to do about it online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on Your Economy. Coming up, empty pockets and light wallets lead to payday lending.
Here lately, I've been using a little bit more. I've kind of got myself in a bind, you know, so I'm just like paycheck to paycheck.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sliced off 112 points today, 0.8% to close at 12,582. The Nasdaq peeled off 22 points, 0.9% to finish at 2331. The S&P 500 unwound 12 points, 0.8%, met the bell at 1367. J.P. Morgan Chase bounced down 4.5% after a few brokerages cut their profit estimate on the bank. Thornburg Mortgage, the residential mortgage lender, plunged more than 15%. It's apparently facing margin calls on $2.9 billion worth of securities backed by, yes, subprime loans. Bank of America shed 3.4% today. The 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 3.67%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. and by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Middle East Reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for January. President Bush receives the Danish Prime Minister at the Bush compound in Crawford, Texas. And the Oscar goes to Hattie McDaniel on February 29, 1940 for Best Supporting Actress. Gone with the Wind swept the award ceremony that year with 8 statuettes, including the first to go to an African-American performer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Real estate doesn't much work this way anymore, but back when the market was still soaring, homeowners were using their houses like ATMs. They'd tap into their equity and spend the money on all kinds of things. Too often it was vacations or new cars, not sensible stuff like new roofs or refrigerators. Now that the bubble has burst, many of those same people owe more money on their homes than the houses are worth, but they still want new stuff, so they're turning to another kind of piggy bank. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The number of workers tapping their retirement plans for loans jumped 7% between 2006 and 2007. That's according to a survey out today from the Transamerica Center for Retirement. Center President Catherine Collinson says it's a worrisome trend.
The entire dynamic of a 401k plan is all about saving on a consistent basis over a long period of time. Any breaks from saving or withdrawals from those accounts is only going to diminish the size of the nest egg when people retire.
Collinson says what's worse is that about half of workers took out those loans to pay off debt. That's roughly doubled from the year before. Liz Pulliam Weston is a personal finance columnist for MSN Money. She says 401k loans do have advantages. Because you're essentially borrowing from yourself, interest rates are low, and your credit's not an issue.
The other big advantage to it, it doesn't show up on your credit report. So you can take that money, pay down the debts that are on your credit report, and make your credit score look better.
Still, Weston says there are huge risks, like if you lose your job.
Most plans are set up so that you are forced to pay back that money within 30 to 90 days. If you don't do so, then the balance of the loan is treated as a withdrawal, and that is a disaster. You owe taxes on that money, you owe penalties on that money, and even worse, you're losing all the future tax-deferred returns you could have earned.
In fact, Weston says for every $1,000 you take out of your 401k, you lose about $10,000 in retirement income. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Tomorrow's Friday, always good. Even better in a lot of places, it's payday. For some, though, you ought to make that payback day. As the economy slides, more people are making do week by week. And when the money runs out before the next check comes in, millions of them are turning to payday lenders. Interest rates on those are high, but Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio, payday loans might actually be worth the price.
Cash Tonic is just another bland storefront in a strip mall in Los Angeles, but it's a happening place on payday. Juanita is one of the customers walking out with cash. She says she visits the payday loan store too much these days.
Here lately, I've been using a little bit more. I've kind of got myself in a bind, you know, so I'm just like paycheck to paycheck.
Juanita and millions of others. The storefront payday industry made about $42 billion in loans in 2006. That, according to business analyst Stevens, Inc., most of the loans were for small amounts, hundreds, not thousands of dollars. If you've never taken out a payday loan, here's how it works. Say you want to borrow $300. You show the clerk your pay stub or proof of a welfare or Social Security check. And you need to have a checking account because that's how you'll pay the loan back. You write a post-dated check that'll be cashed on your next payday. The typical charge to borrow $300? About $45. People usually pay back the loan. They've got money coming in. The problem becomes living on what's left of your paycheck. Many borrowers, like Juanita, have to roll over the loan just to stay afloat.
Anybody that's in the same circumstances I'm in would probably end up doing the same thing. If you get caught up and you need to get a bill paid, then you have to do what you got to do.
Payday loans have gotten a bad rap because of their high interest rates. The businesses are in an ongoing struggle with state regulators. But a few new reports say the loans can actually benefit consumers. One is from a staff economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He looked at what happened in two states after regulators capped interest rates and payday lenders closed up shop in response to the new laws. He found that consumers in those states ended up paying an extra $36 million a year in bounce check fees. The other study out of George Mason University came to a similar conclusion, that payday loans could be beneficial. Economist Bart Wilson led that study.
So when you give people more options, responsible people can take advantage of it and be better off.
Advocates like the Center for Responsible Lending, or CRL, argue that Wilson's study took place in a lab far from the real world. The group says the other study from the Fed used faulty data. Leslie Parrish is a senior researcher at CRL. She says payday loans set most people up for failure.
The vast majority of borrowers continue to be trapped in a long-term debt cycle with these 400% APR loans.
That cycle rings true for Adrena McQuillan of Wilmington, North Carolina. In 2002, she took out a payday loan to help pay her mortgage. Things sort of snowballed from there.
Eventually, I ended up going to like three because I had to finish. You have to borrow from another one to pay another one. That's what I started doing. It's like a never-ending thing, but it was no way out.
Today, McQuillan might be in an even bigger bind. That's because North Carolina is among the dozen states that have caps on interest rates and therefore don't have payday lenders. Nebraska and Colorado are also considering interest limits that could send the industry packing. Lindsay Metzger is with the Community Financial Services Association, a payday loan trade group.
By eliminating storefront payday lenders, you're only driving people to more expensive options that they were trying to avoid, or even to unregulated offshore internet lenders, which are popping up all over the place right now.
Metzger says without payday loan options, consumers suffer while banks and other financial institutions flourish from decreased competition. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. By Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
We'll go out today where we started at the president's press conference via the trading floor at the New York Mercantile Exchange. Crude oil closed at a record 102.59 today, which means gas is eventually going to go up. But I don't think anybody told the president.
What's your advice to the average American who is hurting now, facing the prospect of $4 a gallon gasoline, a lot of people facing...
Wait, what did you just say? You're predicting $4 a gallon gasoline?
A number of analysts are predicting $4 a gallon gasoline this spring when they reformulate.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Hadn't heard that, he said. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dumped 112 points, 8-tenths of 1%. The Nasdaq slid 22 points, 9-tenths%. The S&P 500 dipped 12 points, 8-tenths of 1% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, you say you don't like conferences? Well, how about an unconference?
Non-conference is a conference, but it's participant-driven, so that there is no predefined schedule or program.
Yeah, that'll work. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.